You're now diving into the fish tank.
Sitting down with Seth Living, Seth, OJ, Juice Man, ooh, and this is strictly for them true fans, dog fans, number one. Of course, y'all, this ain't no ordinary sports talk. Dive up in that fish tank.
Welcome back to the Fish Tank, right here on the Miami Dolphins Podcast Network. Seth Levitt, DJ Preach, a little holiday cheer, and the man always giving gifts, OJ McDuffie. Juice, how you feeling today, man?
What's up, Big Seth?
This is a great time. This is my favorite time of the year, and especially when the Dolphins are relevant. You know, we're in the hunt, trying to win a few more games to get into the postseason here. But I'm excited today, Juice. Every week I think I say I'm excited, but since we started this show 2 years ago, there's been two guests that people will not stop asking for.
All the time.
Dan Marino's all right. We know Danny. Okay, we get it. We get it, and we understand the process that it takes to get Danny on this thing. And I don't know that this is the right environment for Dan. So we got to wait till we can get back in front of people. But the other guy that they will not stop asking about, and they can now, because our gift to our listeners is diving into the tank today for the first time. Brian Cox, welcome to the tank, man.
What's happening? What's going on?
B. Cox, my man. What's good, man? So what good up, to see OJ? You, bro.
It's always, brother. Always.
No better way to kick off Buffalo Bills week, right?
That's right. We'll get into that too. Yeah, absolutely, man. So yeah, that's what's up, man. B. Cox is one of my favorites, man. So I can't wait to dive into this one, Big Seth.
I think B. Cox is a lot of people's favorites. And especially, like I'm telling you, Brian, on Twitter, we will not get, they won't stop asking, when's Brian coming in? When's Brian? And we've told, hey, we've been in communication. Juice is talking to him. I can't take any damn credit for it, but Juice has been talking to him. B. Cox said he's going to be in here. We know his word is good. He'll be in here. So we're so excited to have you in, man. There's so much to talk about. And as Preach just said, certainly heading into playing against the Buffalo Bills, there's a lot to talk about there. But what I want to talk about first and foremost is from day one, from the day you got to Miami, and I knew this as a fan, I think certainly guys like Juice who were in the locker room with you, you always had a reputation of being a tough guy from a tough city. Right. I mean, that was a reputation that came with you when you got here. And the truth is, the only reason I've even ever heard of East St. Louis is because I grew up a Dolphins fan and Brian Cox is from East St. Louis, one of the toughest cities in America. Right. That's what we always hear. Tough city. I know that because of Brian Cox. Help us understand, though, what that really means. Talk to us about your hometown. Why does it have that reputation? And how did that impact you and shape the person that you are and who you became, you know, growing up there?
Well, there are a couple different reasons for that. You know, back in the 60s, St. Louis closed early. So people crossed over the Mississippi River to come to East St. Louis to party, to do the after hour joints and to hang out. The toughness of the city came about because, you know, growing up during the era in which I grew up, either you had to fight or you had to run. And I couldn't run, so I had to learn how to fight. And so that's where that came from. But you know, the city is also known as the City of Champions when you look at it for the number of high school championships we won in football and track and field and basketball. So when you look at East St. Louis, you look at the Jackie Joyner Kersee story, Olympian several times over coming from out of there, and the Eric Wright playing for the San Francisco 49ers, and, you know, James Harris playing for the Minnesota Vikings and the Las Vegas Raiders. And you know, you look at the Spinks brothers coming out there. You look at some of the talent that's come from East St. Louis, and it's not just the tough part. People like to talk about that aspect. At one time, it was a wonderful city in which your neighbor and people were able to teach you. And to even, you know, it was back in those days when your next door neighbor, when you got in trouble, your next door neighbor whooped you and sent you home, and then your parents whooped you. So it hadn't always had that reputation, but I think the way that it shaped me was it allowed me to understand that there was never any quit. There was never any give up. There was never any, I'm going to let this person take my dignity or take something from me. So that wasn't what was going to happen from my neighborhood in which I came from in Charlie Park. You wasn't doing that.
You know, so let's talk about, you know, how you got to Miami. You know, Dolphins select you in the fifth round B in 1991. And you made an immediate impact as a rookie. You know, you started 13 games, but you're also a significant contributor on special teams. And I love that about you. When I got there, I couldn't believe how much you did on teams, man, which is something that, you know, that carried on throughout your whole career while you were in Miami. Talk about how you enjoy playing on team, you know, even after, you know, becoming one of the top linebackers in the league. And also talk about playing for Mike Westhoff, man. Mike Westhoff's one of the reasons I got drafted to Miami, too. He's been really, really popular on this show. And, you know, so we know you have to have some great stories about Mike and, you know, your stories on team.
Absolutely. But, you know, here's the funny thing about coming to Miami. I didn't get drafted on the first day. And the second day started early in the morning. So, I, of course, like most young kids, I had a draft party. I was hungover. I had drank so much the night before. I knew I wasn't getting drafted on the first day. The second day, Coach Shula calls me at about 7 o'clock in the morning, and I'm hungover, and I'm sitting there saying, this ain't Don Shula calling me. So I hang up on him. So he calls me back, and he said, what happened? I say, oh, we had a bad connection. And he goes on to tell me that they're going to draft me.
I like it.
Yeah. So he goes on to tell me that he's going to draft me. But Mike Westhoff played a major role in drafting me. He and Coach George Hill, God bless his soul, we lost him a couple weeks ago, and Coach Shula. So George Hill scouted me at Western, and he saw me play multiple roles and fill in multiple roles. Mike Westhoff liked me because in college I blocked 20 kicks or 15 kicks, however many kicks. I don't remember how many it
was. Well, now I need to know, because that's like big-ass numbers.
It was double digit. It was more than 10. It was somewhere between 10 and 20. I don't remember how many. And so he said that the quickest way to make the team is special team. And so I can remember the opening week I was starting against Buffalo, the opening week in 91. I made the opening kick on opening tackle on kickoff, the first tackle of the game against Thurman Thomas. I was on the punt return, the punt team, the kickoff return, and starting. So Mike Westhoff didn't care if you were a starter. It was like, what can you do to help the team?
That's right.
And so for me, as a young kid in the fifth round getting drafted, I remember the Dolphins didn't have a fourth rounder. The first round, we took Randall Hill. Second round, we didn't have one. Third round, we took Aaron Craver. Fourth round, we didn't have one. Fifth round, it was me. And then the second fifth round pick was an offensive guard out of Iowa State. I can't recall his name right now. And so although I was drafted in the fifth round, I was the first defensive player that the Dolphins took that year. So I knew that they liked me. And so from that standpoint, it was the East St. Louis mentality. I'm going here. I'm going to whoop somebody's butt. I ain't going home. You ain't sending me back to East St. Louis. That was the mentality.
Wow.
So, that's what's up.
I love it. But here's a question I have for you. We just had Alindo Mari on. And granted, you know, Mike might treat a kicker differently than he's going to treat a 6'4 linebacker.
No, he didn't.
So that's what I want to know. Because Mike, they're talking about Mike would motherfuck people and he'd point his cane at you and say, you know, Lindo said it was lightning out. And Mike said he held his cane up and said, I'm going to point this at your fucking head if you mean to miss another kick. So the lightning hits you. And Lindo was all in his feelings about it. Did he talk to you like that? Like, did he have to
know? Yeah, absolutely. You know, back then, our coaching staff was so good, so professional, so much like father figures. I'm talking about from Tom Olivandotti to George Hill to Mel Phillips. Those guys were stalwarts. And the good thing about those guys is back during those days, they go and golf with us sometimes. So Mel Phillips would be out there. You would be out there with George Hill and you'd be playing. So you get to know the guys away from the building.
Yeah.
You got to understand who they were and what they were to their family. Mike Westhoff has always been, I'm going to say, crazy. I can remember playing golf with Mike in the 90s, in the early 90s, maybe 92. I don't think they played golf with me when I was a rookie, but maybe that second or third year I started to play golf with those guys. Mike Westhoff took his whole bag of clubs and threw them in the lake because he hit a bad shot. he probably at Grand Oaks was back then was
Rolling Hills.
Rolling Hills.
Yeah.
He probably got clubs still up in some of those trees. I mean, he would throw clubs up in the tree. I mean, he'd be cussing. I mean, Mike ain't changed. And then when I worked with him when he came to the Jets, he was still the same guy. So he ain't never changed. He's coached everybody the same, regardless of what your status may have been. It was like, I don't care if you're the starter. I don't care if you started 10 years. You're going to be on the punt team. I mean, right. And that's just who he is. And that's what you love about him.
Mike, hey, Brian, you know, I used to love those Monday meetings, man, especially after a win, when the whole team is in there, special teams, coaches, trainers, and Mike Westhoff running that film, man. And if you make a mistake, if you fuck up, man, boy, did he illuminate it. How many times? He running back like 7 or 8 times and put you on the spot, man. But it was like you said, he treated everybody the same, man. Nobody was untouchable in those situations, man. I'm up a punt. He's in my ass. You miss a tackle, he was going to be in your ass, man. That was the fun part about Westhoff, because he treated everybody the same. And teams were the way in for a lot of guys.
Right. And even coaches, you know, Westhoff would tell a coach. I can remember a coach, and this wasn't in Miami. This is when we worked together in New York. But I can remember him telling the coach who had said to him, hey, let's not get our kicker hurt running down the field making a tackle. He said, you could tell him that, but I'm not going to tell him that. He's a football player. He get paid. His ass going to make a tackle.
Yeah. Mike doesn't want to give one up, man.
No.
So, not on his record, for sure.
So he's been that way for as long as I've known it.
That's great. So, look, playing for Mike is one thing, but we also have to talk about Don Shula. So, what, you know, I guess you didn't get off to a great start hanging up on him, but what was your relationship like with Coach? And is there a favorite Don Shula story that you have?
I got many favorite stories about Don Shula. Donald Franklin Shula, otherwise known as Shifty Shula, as they called him when he played. But the thing that people don't understand about him is one impeccable name. You've never heard his name associated with anything negative. You've never heard him associated with any cheating or anything to be anything other than wonderful. I feel like in my time, I played for 3 Hall of Fame coaches, and Coach Shula, Coach Parcells, and Coach Belichick. Belichick ain't in there yet, but it's just a formality. Don Shula treated you like a man. I mean, he wasn't afraid to have a tough conversation. And a lot of times when I got in trouble, it was always cuss me out, whatever it was, you crazy. I got a crazy linebacker. I got a linebacker that don't know if he want to play. And I'd say to him, who's crazy? Like you. And he turned to me after I did something. But he always ended it with, I love you. And let's get ourselves together. Let's get prepared for this week. And the story that I'm going to tell you that's probably my favorite story about Coach Shula is, well, I got 2 favorite stories I'm going to tell you. One's X-rated and one's not.
We'll take them both.
We'll take them both. Absolutely.
The first one is when he was forced out and he retired. I had retired and moved into television. I was in L.A. doing the Best Damn Sports Show, period. He was coming out there to open the season's 52, or maybe it was, I don't know if it was season 52 or one of his restaurants.
One of Shula's maybe, yeah.
And he called me and he told me, he invited me and my wife and my father-in-law and my mother-in-law, and he said, I want y'all to come to the opening of this show. I got there. He treated my in-laws and my wife like they were royalty. And it was, Brian, come on. And it was, I love you. And it was, I mean, that was the last time that I saw him outside of this next story I'm going to tell you. So I go to San Francisco to pick up my Super Bowl tickets. I'm a coach now. And I'm coaching in, I don't know where I'm coaching. But anyway, some of these staffs now, they make you go to the city of the Super Bowl to pick up your tickets instead of giving you your tickets. So they trying to make it hard so you don't want your tickets.
Yeah, you can get them and sell them. Going to have to go get these tickets.
Right, they make you fly. So I'm in San Francisco before Super Bowl 50. It's the Carolina and Broncos Super Bowl. And I'm going to the hotel to get my tickets. I get my tickets. I walk out. Who do I see? Coach Shula. He's not walking now. He's in a wheelchair. Hmm. And so they bring him off the bus. And he shoots me the bird. He gives me the bird.
I love it.
I say, what are you doing? He say, I'm just doing everything that you taught me.
Oh, man. And I said, he learned from the best, Brian.
That's what he say. He say, I learned from the best. I'm doing what you taught me. And he told me he loved me, and that was the last time I saw him alive. That time there. So it was special. Wonderful, wonderful man. I still don't think he gets enough credit. And one of the reasons I left the Dolphins was I didn't like how he got forced out. And me, Marco Coleman, and Troy Vincent, we made a pact. I was at the Super Bowl when I came back to meet with Jimmy Johnson. He had called a team meeting. And when we got back, he said, well, I don't want you back. Jimmy Johnson never wanted me back in Miami. But I told him, okay, if you don't bring me back, you don't get Troy Vincent, you don't get Marco Coleman. He said, well, we'll see about that. Mm. He said, my friend Dave Weinstadt got a good contract for you. He wants you in Chicago. So I said, okay, cool. But just remember, you don't get me, you don't get Marco, you don't get Troy. So he was calling Troy to get Troy to sign back. Troy would never call back. So Troy signed with the Philadelphia Eagles. He was trying to get Marco to come back. He was calling Marco. Marco don't come back. He goes out to San Diego to play for his college coach. And so that's how we left. If Don Shula stays at Miami, I'd never leave. Because you're talking about somebody that I had the utmost respect for and I love to death and I love how he treated you like a man. I possibly spent my whole career in Miami.
And that's incredible, B. Because you know what? I sat there. I was one of the last couple of guys, like me and Danny, some of the last couple of guys that actually, you know, pushed over to the Jimmy Johnson regime.
Mm-hmm.
And Seth, and everybody knows, been, I've said it on the show a bunch of times, I'm not a fan of the dude either. And I remember sitting next to Shoes, man, one of my favorite coaches of all time, and saying, like, you know, Shoes was like, man, it's amazing how quickly to forget what you've done around here.
Right.
You know? But, man, I love that loyalty, man, because you know what happened? When you lose you, you lose Troy Vincent, you lose Marco Coleman,
mm-hmm.
We lost our defense. I know he wanted to get younger, but imagine you guys playing with the young guys with that team
right.
that came in after that, man. It'd have been right. sick. It'd right. have been sick, man.
It would have been crazy. But like you said, to me, the loyalty I have for Shula, and that's how people don't know how close we were in terms of I didn't see him a lot, and I regret it from the standpoint of when he died, I hadn't seen him for a year or two. That was my fault. I take responsibility for that. But, you know, Coach Shula wasn't a guy that was a personal guy that did the personal stuff. Probably out of the three guys that I named as Hall of Fame coaches, not probably. The guy that I spend most of my time with is Parcells. That's the guy that I can call up right now. We could talk about whatever. Coach Shula and I had that kind of relationship that I could call him. But as he got older and I got older, we kind of not drifted, but we didn't have that communications. And I put that on me because he was a guy that taught me a lot. He taught me a lot about loyalty. He taught me a lot about selflessness. He taught me a lot about teamwork. He taught me a lot about manhood. And for all the things that I did as a player in Miami that wasn't probably mature, as you would say, for me, I matured probably a little later than some people because I didn't understand what a quality of life was. All I knew was I'm going to go out there and try to kick somebody's ass for 3.5 hours and not go to jail. That to me was football. You know, what my little league coaches told me when I was a little kid about football was you're in 60 fights per game. And how many individual fights can you win out of those 60? So for me, that's what my upbringing, football was about. And so for me, that's how I played the game. Every play was a fight. I wasn't playing football. I was fighting. And growing up, like a lot of people would probably resort back to, that was a mirror image of my background of growing up. You had to learn how to fight. And football was just a fight.
So when you're taking on the entire Cincinnati Bengals sideline, you know, that was where everybody else is like, holy shit, this guy's taking on it. That's just another play
that's,
for you.
That's normal.
60 fights.
That's right. Normal, you know. And so that's one thing that I will say this, you know, right now on this podcast. When you're talking about brotherhood, when you're talking about friends, I've never played on a team as close as we were in Miami. Anywhere else. I played for 5 teams total. Nowhere ever was, you couldn't simulate what we did in Miami. It was a real brotherhood and a family thing. Guys would go over each other's house with their families on Wednesdays and Thursdays. It didn't even have to be a reason to have a party. It was, we're going over here, we're going to have dinner with this family. If you saw one person in the mall, you probably saw 5. If you went to the strip club back then at the Rolex, if you saw 5 of us, you probably saw 15 of us. Yeah. We were all in there. And we were all
in the strip
together.
Club in the mall, apparently.
Or You will see us at somebody's house, and it will be all the men over there probably playing cards or shooting dice. The women would be in the kitchen around food and hanging out, and the kids would be out in the pool. And I mean, you saw that all the time. I never had that feeling with another team.
That's really fascinating to me. And Juice, I want to ask you too, right? Because you guys crossed over some eras there. And I started in 96, Jimmy's first year. I know how you guys feel about Jimmy. I had a different experience, and that's fine because I was in a different role. But so JT, who I work for in my day job, Jason Taylor, you know, he played under a handful of coaches here in Miami. But when he went to Washington, he said that it was a different football experience because there was the bond, the brotherhood, everything that you're describing during your era, Brian. He felt that as well. Juice, we've talked about the basketball games at your house, even during the Jimmy Johnson years and the Wanstead years. There was a closeness that existed. And I wonder how much of that carried over from what Coach Shula developed. And it did, despite the head coach, it carried over here in Miami because JT said he went to Washington and when practice was over, 52 guys went 52 separate ways. They didn't have this thing that Brian was saying. And he, you know, he played for the Jets and had a good season there. But I've heard a lot of guys say that. And Lindo was just on and talked about his first few years here in Miami were like no other year. So what do you think that is that's growing down here that's causing all of you guys to bond like that?
I think it was the Shula experience for myself. Because Parcells, like I said, is my guy. Me and him have conversations. I don't make an important decision without calling him first right now.
That's a tough one for me to swallow, Juice.
Bill, not for everybody.
Right.
You know, Bill, not for everybody. Just like Jimmy Johnson, not for everybody.
Not for everybody, yeah. Right. Fair enough.
So for me, the connection with me and Bill was bigger than football. For me, the first time I ever met Bill and walked up to him, I said, hey, coach, how you doing? He said, my name's Bill. So that put me and him on a different level right there. And I could remember a situation when I was going through a divorce. He would pick up the phone and call me and say, you doing the right thing? You taking care of your responsibility? You being a man? Like we would have conversations that was not about football. And that's what endeared me to him. And so whenever something has happened over the last few years, I have a resource that I could pick up the phone. If you wasn't his guy, you can't call him.
Right.
You know, but he's not for everybody. You know, Bill is a straight up guy. And if he don't think you straight up or you and him had a run in, he never forgets that he's like an elephant. And somehow, some way he's going to screw you. That was not who Coach Shula was. Coach Shula didn't have them kind of issues. And to me, that's one of the things that's missing in the NFL right now. You get these coaches that come out there who are X and O guys, but have no leadership skills, have no compassion, can't pull you into the office and say, hey, let's have this conversation man to man. And you go and MF each other back and forth. Right. And at the end of the conversation, he say, we all right. We're on the same page. All right, I love you. Let's go figure out a way how to win. Yeah. That's what this league is missing now.
It's a man-to-man shit.
Ain't no leadership.
And that leadership piece is interesting, Brian, as you say that. And, you know, down here, and look, I'm not in the building anymore. Juice knows this better than I do. But one thing, when you look at Coach Flores from an outsider looking in, you see leadership. You see a man who, you know, that from what I see, you know, again, I'm not there. This looks like someone that exactly what you're saying, that a player looks in his eyes and he looks in that player's eyes and they're on that level there and he's in charge and he's a leader and he's going to tell him what he needs to tell him. And we're starting to see a response there. So it's interesting for me to hear what you're saying.
Yeah. But that's another reason why you see it. You know, Brian Flores comes from New England where he's held every job you can hold over there. He's been a scout. He's learned it from that standpoint and he's built his way up to become defense coordinator without the title and then getting the title and then going down there. But, you know, the one thing that you say about Bill Belichick guys is most of them don't have success because they try to be him. Mm. You can't be Bill Belichick because Bill Belichick, I don't know what kind of person he is away from football. He won't go out and have dinner with players. He won't, you know, like.
You didn't golf with him, Brian?
I didn't golf with him. You know, his deal was like, we keep it separate because if I got to make a decision, I want to be able to chop your head off.
Right.
But I bring up his name and his point to bring up the fact that all the guys that have coached for him that have went on to become head coaches don't have success because they can't emulate the hard stuff that has to happen when I got to release you or I got to cut you or I got to trade you or Tom Brady, I don't want you back here. So you go talk to the owner and y'all figure it out, but I'm moving on. Those type things, all those coaches get, it's probably 12 of them guys, but not many of them have winning records. Bill O'Brien and Flores probably the only two guys that sniff winning records.
Yeah, and that's a good point about Coach Flo's, because Coach Flo came in right away, like telling these veteran guys that thought they were the shit that I don't care. You know what I mean? He lets some guys go and trades, flat out release. That's that Bill Belichick and him right there that probably got the respect from a lot of other players on that team or people in that locker room.
You call it a public execution. You take one of your best players and you cut him or you trade him or you do something that make everybody else stand up and be like, if we can do it to him, you can sure enough do it to me.
Or eight or nine of them.
Yeah, but that's the technique. That's the leadership, though. So it's a point of you have guys that can call plays on offense or defense, but you have to have a man who can stand up in front of the room and hold people accountable. The most important thing to me, if I'm searching for a head coach, is leadership. I can find a guy, a coordinator, on either side of the ball to take care of the X's and O's, but I need to be able to lead men.
Yeah.
And that's what most of these young cats can't do. These guys come in, they smart, and they shit don't stink, and then all of a sudden they go in there and they can't win, and they're like, I can't figure it out. Yeah, because you're not a leader.
You know what it is, Beacox, man, is a lot of these dudes can't handle personalities, man. They can't handle big personalities, man. They can't handle it. And I tell you this, and I say this with guys like Jimmy, there were some guys that had big personalities, but Jimmy had a big personality. Shula had a big personality. He wasn't afraid of that situation.
Right.
Some of these guys want to be, they're afraid of that situation as head coaches because these big personalities, you know, makes them look bad or outshines them sometimes. And it's a problem sometimes.
Right. But at the end of the day, if we're all pulling in the same direction and we're all for the same team, it shouldn't matter your personality versus my personality because we're doing it for the same reason, you know? And I just think that that's one of the things that the owners get wrong sometimes is that they go for the big play caller and not the big leader.
All right, B, you know what, man? I'm going to go back a little bit. You know, we talked about you getting drafted in 91. You know, I got drafted in 93.
Right.
And I remember my first big purchase. The only time I had a little couple bucks in my pockets was my GMC Typhoon. And the only guy I knew in the parking lot that had one too was you. I had a black one.
You had a white one.
Yeah. You know what I mean? And I was like, I was wondering how you felt about, you know, this young rook coming in with the baddest truck ever made at that point. You know what I mean? And I know you were loving yours, man, because there was no better vehicle on earth than that GMC Typhoon, man. I couldn't wait to. I never even test drove mine. I just bought it. I said, I know I want it. I saw it in the magazine. I got to get it. How'd you come about getting yours, man? And what'd you think about this rook over here getting one as well?
Hey, man. You know what? I bought the car only because it had a Corvette engine in it. And I was like, I want something fast. And I would be on the expressway after leaving the club sometime 2, 3, 4 in the morning. And I would open that thing up, man. And I'd be close to 200. I'd be getting it.
Damn.
That's badass.
200?
Man, I'm telling you, man, it was that thing. I'd only open it up when nobody was around. So if somebody got hurt, it was going to only be me. You know, I didn't put anybody's life in danger but my own. And I just wanted to see how fast that thing went because that was the only reason I really bought it. It had a Corvette engine in it. And that thing would open up. And the fact that OJ had one, I wasn't tripping. It's all love, baby.
You were okay? Because some guys don't like that shit. Like,
Hey, man. It's for us. We together.
Okay. Well, it's Big so Richmond funny. Said it's... he saw Juice. Richmond said he saw yours. He was ready to go get one as well. He said he liked little cars for some reason.
Yeah, it might have been a little too big for Richmond.
It's so funny, too, because you mentioned Aaron Craver because he's the one that put the system in my car.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had a little radio. He had a system shop right around the corner from the facility. So he was doing both.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's the first time I had like 220s in there as well, man. I didn't have no air conditioning. My air conditioner went out. But man, it was hot.
You drove it to 220, or that you had 220s in the back?
220, it was 220 right. You know what I mean? You know, the house speakers in the back.
Well, I don't know. B. Costner said he had that thing almost at 200 miles an hour. So.
Hey, man, it was getting it. I was getting it. Wow. And I used to have a good time.
So, right. The thing was, I got challenged light to light on mine all the time, man. You know what I mean? And they didn't realize we had light to light speed because it had all wheel drive, Seth. It was 0 to 60 in 4.2 seconds or something. It's a truck. This is like a SUV, you know what I mean? So anybody want to try us, try.
I had some aftermarket stuff done.
I bet you did, B. I had the
speakers and everything in it. It was hooked up.
It was still moving like that.
You know, when you talked about family a little bit too, man, and I guess I became part of the family when you and Tony Martin and Urban Fryer and all y'all, you know, taped me up and threw me in the cold tub. Yeah, as a rookie. That's why it's part of the family, right?
Everybody had to go. But here's the thing, though. You guys thought you had it bad. You didn't have it bad. When I came in, okay, I'm drafted in 1991. I come in, the linebackers on the team, Hugh Green, EJ Jr., John Offerdahl, John Grimsley, Cliff Odom. It was like seven guys all had 10 to 12, 13 years.
Right.
But guess what they did to me, okay? We go on the road to play during the preseason. And we had roommates back in those days. Hugh Green took the cover off the bed, laid it on the floor and said, don't touch this bed, sleep on the floor. And he went out back then. Everybody would sneak out the room. He went out and said, when I come back, you better not be in the bed. So I said, okay, I'm trying to get a good night's sleep. So I sleep on the floor. When I come back, he comes in the room, jump on me, drunk, and we wrestling at about 4 o'clock in the morning.
Before a game.
Before a game. This was preseason, though. This was preseason.
Okay.
But it's like...
You're trying to make a team.
Right. And they worried about getting thrown in the pool.
Right.
I'm trying to make the team the night before a game and try to get some rest. And I get a vet come in and jump on me, and we wrestling. I'm talking about full-out wrestling at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning.
What the hell is going on?
I'm like, either one of us could have got hurt because it was almost a fight.
Right.
Yeah, I'm doing what you said. I ain't sleeping in the bed, man. I'm on the floor. Why are you coming in here about... But those guys taught me so much about football. And, you know, that pours into the family because those guys back then, during those times, people won't believe this, but I tell people all the time that Hugh Green, especially, would go out, stay out to 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, go straight to the facility, and when you get in the morning about 6, he's already run 4 miles, he's been in the hot tub, he's already lifted weights, he's already done all that before 6 o'clock in the morning.
Sounds like somebody else I know on this show.
But it was a real veteran group, and those guys would stand me on the side and say, okay, tell me what the play is, what we doing, what you doing, where are your eyes at? That's how I learned ball. In this day and age, cats will be out there trying to tell you all the wrong stuff. It's a pass. They're going to try to tell you stuff so that you don't take their job. Right. Those guys were teachers. Those guys were true big brothers, only wanting the best for you, even though it was going to cost them their job. And so that's why I had respect for that era so much.
I think that's a great point. I think a lot of that became the culture, man. When you have a consistent head coach that's been there for a while, I think that culture, man, it goes a long way. Shula really had a bunch of guys that, you know, that were in a brotherhood. It was a family. And, you know, when you see teams with all these coaches coming and going, there's no camaraderie. There's no continuity. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But when you got a guy like that, I think he brings in guys like that. We all get it. Because when I came in, think about this. I came in and Duper and Clayton were there. Mm-hmm. I was coming for their job, or guys like, you know, Mike Williams or Scott Miller, and they all were teaching me how to run the offense. Mm-hmm. I'm coming to take their job like you're talking about, man. Mm-hmm. So if you think it starts like with Coach Shoes and the culture that's built over years and you know, decades of just winning football for one, but winning as a family for two.
For sure. It had to be that, because it was not that way anywhere else that I was. You know, even though I played for Wanstead in Chicago, and I thought Wanstead was great. I just didn't think that he was the talent evaluator that a lot of these coaches are. He was a great coach, no issues, but like you know, I was playing middle linebacker and the D tackle was playing in front of me, Chris Zorich and what's the name of, they were both about my size. I was like, what the hell are we doing here? You know,
yeah. But how you going to keep these divisions off me? How you going to keep them off me?
Right. You know, or I'm going to keep them off of them. Right, I'm going to keep the offensive line off of them. But it was like Chicago was not my best experience. I mean, the team was fine, but I just didn't think that the organization was such that there could be success. When I went to the Jets, Parcells teaches out of fear. So if you ain't doing your job, it's like he'd sit in the room and say, I tolerate until I can replace. And so I'm going to tolerate you until I can replace you. And then to go to New England and play for Belichick, it was the same thing. It was no different. And then I ended up in New Orleans with Jim Haslett. Again, good coach. We were decent as a team in terms of spending time with each other, but I've never experienced what I experienced in Miami.
Because I got to ask you, man, this is like an iconic photo of you in Chicago. You talk about Chicago a little bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see you back by the goalpost. I think it might have been extra point or field goal. I think you might have had your helmet on. Was it backwards?
Always backwards, right?
Was it backwards?
It depends on when, because there were a couple situations. One, I took my helmet and threw it in the stand, so I didn't have a helmet. So I was on the field without a helmet for the extra point. And one time I had it on backwards down by the end zone. It was just, Chicago was just not a good deal.
I hear you.
Okay. All right. Well, here's what we're going to do. There's no sense bullshitting around anymore. As Preach said, we're heading into Buffalo here. We all know what this week is about. And again, you know, it's a rivalry again, which is fantastic. Your career, Brian, will always be tied to your unique, I'll use it, you know, you quoted something earlier. I'm going to quote, unique relationship with that team, with that city, certainly with those fans in Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
At what point does shit go sideways in Buffalo? And what's the real story behind the middle fingers, that famous vision that we have of you being escorted off the field with, you know, Inspector Clouseau over there and Stu and that, you know, all the stuff that we've seen. And we've heard a lot about this, but I really want to hear it from you, that how did stuff turn the way it turned to get to that point in Buffalo?
Again, I take responsibility. It was me. It was me. I'd made a comment in 92 or 93 that all the men were uneducated and all the women were fat. And that kind of pissed him off. But that led to most of the acrimony that you saw from the, you know, the years, the buildup and the things. One thing is I couldn't stand them. You know, I'd go to the Pro Bowl and I'd be over there and Jim Kelly would be talking to women like, hey, honey, bring me a drink and this and that. And like, you know, I'm Jim Kelly. And I'm like, right. Who does that? You know, and you would get over there and Bruce Smith would just be casual. And, you know, I like Bruce now. We become kind of friends. But during that time, I think it was me using those visuals to get me angry and stoked up. And so when I made that comment about their fans, to no surprise, I go to the stadium and they're throwing AAA batteries at me. And they hit me with the AAA batteries. Crazy. And so one game, I come out with the handkerchief over my nose and my mouth, and I got it covered because I'm like, ain't nothing to say now. We're here to play. It's time to play. So all the talking, y'all can keep talking. I'm going to take care of business. And so we get up there and we beat them the first time I do that. The second time we go up there and play them, the next year is where we getting murdered. And I'm like, we can't win the game. Might as well win the war. So I try to kick Caldwell Gordon in his nuts. Start stomping on him, trying to stomp him in his nuts. And so I get kicked out the game. And
Fence.
So, you know, that was the whole thing. But, you know, now when you look back at it 30 years or so ago, you just think about, you know, how immature I was. And sometimes as a person, when you're young and you don't fully understand what's happening, it don't matter. But as you get older, you try to say, I was a fool. I did foolish things at that point. And so you don't want people to go around and emulate that and think that that was cute. That was immature. It was foolishness. And so if I could go back and change some things, I'd probably change some things. But at the end of the day, that Roy motion is what made me a good player. So to take that away, I'm not sure how that will work, but I would like to think that I'm a whole lot smarter now.
You know, and Brian, that's a great point right there. And I've got some things to say about that, the whole Buffalo situation. I know the fans have some choice words that they were using too, as you were, you know, telling how they were number one as well. But at the same time, though, you and me kind of like different, kind of same, but playing different positions. You know, neither one of us were the fastest guys in our position. We weren't the strongest guys in our position, but we tried to be the tough as hell guys in our position. Mm-hmm. And they weren't going to take that away from us, man. Right. You know, and that's one of the things I talk about. You talk about Carwell Gardner, and it's so funny you talk about, you know, how it was your fault. But also think about, I mean, I remember the fans and how they treated you on your way out of that stadium at that point. There were some choice words they were using too. You know what I mean? And that wasn't cool either, no matter what you called them, the level they stooped to, you know, is unacceptable. And Stewart told us about, you know, some of the things that they were saying to you as you were being escorted off the field.
I mean, at the end of the day, though, you know, I still take responsibility. I can't be responsible for their action. Right. I can't take responsibility and accountability for mine. And fair. I also remember being in a situation where the FBI had to stay around my room. They wouldn't let people come on the floor by me because people were sending actual death threats. And so, you know, when you get to that point, I'm not a guy that's afraid because you send a death threat. I'm like, come get some. Let's go.
That's what I'm wondering. Like, what are you thinking at that moment? But I guess that's what it is.
Let's get it.
Bring it.
But what people didn't understand back then is before 9/11, everybody used to take their pistol on the road. Everybody had their gun with them, you know.
Right. We didn't go through any airports. We just went through straight to the plane.
You just went straight to the plane. Everybody had their gun on them. So if I'm jumped off, somebody getting shot first. In my mind, I'm going to come up out of here. I'm getting back to see my wife and kids.
I just remember every trip to Buffalo was like psychological warfare. In the middle of the night in the hotel, you'd have smoke alarms being pulled. So the alarm would go off throughout the hotel. We'd have to make sure it wasn't a real fire. I mean, there was those things all the time that happened in Buffalo. It was not like that anywhere else.
Yeah, but I think, again, that all became the rival, and it was a part of the stuff off the field. Because football wise, we couldn't beat them guys. And that's what made me angry more than anything. Like, I respect them. And I take responsibility for my part. But when you start talking about a man's life and doing something to him that way, that's something altogether different. And again, when you have FBI agents in front of your door, and you go to walk out the door and they tell you you can't go get nothing to eat, or to not answer your phone because it's probably going to be a death threat, that's not fun. Right. And it got away from football and got into some real life stuff. Right. And so at the end of the day, man, I'm just thankful. And it's so ironic that now my son is on their practice squad. I haven't been to Buffalo. But my son wasn't even born, or maybe 6 months, when a lot of this stuff occurred. So he shouldn't be held accountable for that. And when he signed with the team, there were so many people saying, I don't want him on the team. He sucks. He's a cox. But from what my son has said, they've treated him nothing but wonderfully since he's been there. And I'm just a proud dad. I'm happy for my son. I got to live my dream and experience life the way that was unique and special to me. I want him to be able to feel the same thing with his career. I want him to know that I'm just proud of him. I'm a proud dad, and I want him to be successful.
Absolutely. And he certainly shouldn't have to pay for your relationship with the city. But are you a bit conflicted? Like, where?
No.
How do you feel? So
I'm a proud dad. I want my son to live his dream.
Right.
Miami playing Buffalo. I'm rooting for Buffalo.
Oh, man. That's hard to hear coming out of your mouth, but I get it.
I'm a proud father. Who would you root for?
Absolutely. I would do the same thing, but I wasn't.
Why would you have a problem?
You know what I'm saying?
So why would you have a problem with me rooting for
No, I don't have a problem. It's just a hard thing.
Why is it hard to swallow?
A hard thing to hear.
I'm just being a dad.
Right, for
I
sure.
I want my son to be successful.
Yeah, it would be messed up if you didn't. Like, that would be messed up if you didn't. But as a Dolphins fan, it's just hard to hear.
Hey, man.
Brian Cox is going to root for Buffalo over the Dolphins. That's
you got to also realize that the Dolphins left a sour taste in his mouth, man, the way out.
I get
you know what I mean?
I get it all. Yeah, I understand it.
He played for different teams. Like, if he played for one team, I get it. But he played for different teams, and at the end of our tenure here, it wasn't cool.
But it's hard because you telling me that I played 5 years in Miami. And not only what I did on the field in those 5 years, did off the field, visiting the schools and doing turkey Thanksgiving giveaway, I don't get into the Ring of Honor because I didn't play. And this is nothing against Zach, and this is nothing against Jason. They play there. You put my stats up in 5 years. If you put mine 5 years against Zach's, mine going to be better. But is it I didn't play long enough? And I'm happy that Jason them in there. But when you're a player and when you're competitive, you play to have your name on the stadium or in the Ring of Honor. And I think if you look at my statistics, I deserve to be in the Ring of Honor, and I've not yet been able to get that award.
Yeah, that's an interesting conversation in and of itself, right? Because I don't know now what decisions are made or how those decisions are made. I mean, when I was working for the PR staff and names would come up, and I think at some point, you know, some of those names were easier to decide than others in the timing of all those. But it is fascinating, and we talk a lot about the Hall of Fame, right? When we had Richmond on, we talked about how is Richmond Webb not in the
Hall of Fame? How is Richmond not in the Hall of Fame?
Absolutely.
It's not possible.
Yeah, we had Jason Cole on, who was a Hall of Fame voter, and we had a heated debate about it. You know, man. So I don't.
He got the business on this podcast.
He did. So that's a fascinating conversation. Have you talked to Nat about it?
I spoke to Nat. I did speak to Nat about it. I spoke to Harvey about it. Like, Harvey, I'm not pushing for something I don't deserve. Why is my name not ever come up?
And what was the Harvey Green response? I need to know what the Harvey Green response was.
Well, you didn't play long enough. Me and Harvey tight, so Harvey don't have to lie to me. Harvey can be honest because he's seen me at my worst and he's seen me at my best, and he knows who I am as a person to the core. So Harvey's not afraid of me. Yeah. Harvey was like, the 5 years, that's the one thing. Hey, man,
that sounds about right.
for what I did off the field, there should be enough to get me into the Ring of Honor.
We need to have a follow-up conversation with Nat then, Juice.
I ain't even talking about the amount of tackles and stuff. If you look at the stuff that was done off the field, was more than enough to submit me as a favorite Dolphin. And then you put on the field with the heart and the stuff that I did, it's like that one stung me. It stung me a little bit because nowhere else have I played long enough. I would agree everywhere else was 2 years, 1 year, 3 years, that I wouldn't deserve it. But my best numbers and only Pro Bowls and all pro seasons came in Miami.
And I'm going to tell you this, man. I was always, always happy, man, that you were on my sideline, bro, in my locker room, you know. I mean, you're one of the best teammates I ever had. Always had everybody's back. You did, but you played it on the edge at times, man. A lot of emotion, man. I love that about you, man. Probably angry at times, and some of that comes out of being out of St. Louis, you know.
But that's the brotherhood, though. And it's like when you play for one team and you go to another team, you got a new set of brothers. But those guys that you leave behind are still your brothers.
Yeah.
People don't understand that. People get mad sometimes. Like, how are you talking to that guy, man? Me and that guy together whoop your ass.
Right.
That's my brother. You my brother now, but I've been knowing you a month. I've known this guy for 5 years. So I know what he is, you know, and some people don't understand that. Yeah. Because of free agency and because people switch teams so often now, man, I got brothers all over this country. I got dudes that I ain't seen since Miami that call me and say, my daughter goes to school up there. I might need you to go slip a few dollars and I'll ship it back to you. Or this boy is up there messing with my daughter and it's getting out of hand. I might need you to go see him. Okay, I can do that. That's brotherhood, though. Mm-hmm. That's brotherhood. And some cats from some other teams wouldn't do that or don't do that because, like Jason said, most of the places you go at 3:30, everybody getting their car and go separate ways. You don't have friends like that. I used to play for the Jets, and I would be calling people in Miami 2 weeks or a week before we play at Miami. Hey, when I come down there, I want to get some of this food or this food. Got you, bro. No problem.
Right.
That's the difference. People don't understand that.
And, you know, and think about this, though, B, like, you know, your football way of doing things, you know, as you not anger, but just so emotional about it all. How did you take that and then transition that into coaching? You know, where you might have to deal with some guys that had some issues, not issues, but the emotional part of them that you had to calm down sometimes to keep from hurting the team at times or even like getting the team boosted at times.
Well, two things. One, when I was a player, I was in control, meaning that nothing happened without me okaying it or saying so. Because if anything happened as a leader, I was going to take that on, good, bad, or otherwise. Whether it was going to have drinks with a guy that was not playing his best ball and saying, hey, you got to get on it. You're not doing your job. Or it was telling guys, hey, man, you ain't getting no haircuts during meeting time. Take your ass in the meeting and get your haircut when it's your time. It was a delicate balance between being the captain of the team and having to deal with the coaching staff and having to deal with the players and trying to make sure everybody's on the same page. That was a tough feat. But it also prepared me so that when I became a coach, now that leadership that we talk about, I'm dealing with guys in my room. Hey, man, let's stay off of social media. Let's not post nothing stupid. Let's not do all that. We killing that right off the top. I had a couple run-ins with a couple guys that somebody in those organizations said that those guys could play. And then when they come in there and they have an attitude and they're sorry, then I call them out on some stuff. And then I had some issues with some guys. I'd like to think that a little older, a little more wisdom, I could handle those situations a little more delicately or do something different to make sure I foster a better relationship with those type individuals. But coaching to me is nothing but my playing days and becoming a coach. It's just like I was a player. But it hurts me a little bit because I think that my attitude, that alpha male sometime as a player, when I was controlling it, I don't need to control it now. The players have to control it.
Right.
So I think I can be a little easier on the guys.
You kind of got Shula on you a little bit. Shula got a little nicer later in his days, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah. But that's perspective. It's all how you see things. You know, now I used to could yell at you. Now I can put my arm on your shoulder and say, hey, man, here's how we're going to do that. It's the maturity brings that about.
And it's interesting to hear you say that, Brian, because earlier this year, I know when we were talking about getting you on the podcast, you did an interview with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and it really jumped out at me. I think you probably know which interview I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about the fact that you've been out of coaching for 4 years now, and that there was a lot of self-reflection, self-evaluation, which we're hearing already in this interview. But what really stood out to me was you said you started to realize that there were people who were close to you or you thought were close to you who felt that they had a hard time approaching you. Mm-hmm. And that was something that was, that you didn't expect. And you were trying to explore why that would be, why these folks mm-hmm. that you felt you had such a close relationship with didn't feel that they could come and approach you. Can you talk about that a little bit more? Mm-hmm. And maybe even, you know, in the 6 months it's been since you had that interview, have you had the time to reflect and think through that even more?
Yeah, yeah. I think some of it was based on reputation, and some of it's based on me not being open to listening.
Mm.
You know, it's a situation where when you get put in charge of a room, you say, I'm going to run the room this way because these are the type of players I have in the room. Some of them don't understand. Some of them are immature. And then this group over here kind of understands. So I pretty much don't have to really handle this group. I can let them kind of do it because they're professional and they understand what it's about. This side of the room, I'm going to have to be more hands-on and I'm going to have to walk them through it and I'm going to have to force feed them, meaning extra meeting time. We're going to send a meeting and I got to go through things like this. When it came to coaches and when it came to people in the building that I thought were my friends, could come up to me and say, hey, man, let's not do this or let's do that. Or my boss, we friends, but you my boss, the head coach, where Dan could come and say, hey, Brian, I don't want to do it this way. I want to do it like that. Cool. That's how we're going to do it. But to say nothing, and then at the end of the year, when you say, I'm going to make a change, I'm going to fire you, start running down the laundry list of things, and you didn't give me a chance to respond to any of them or to rectify. Like, if you was my friend, you would come to me and say, hey, Brian, this is what I need you to do. I need you to do this, this, this. But don't tell me I'm doing a great job. And then at the end of the year, you say, I know. Come on, man, that ain't cool. But I got to take my responsibility and say, in what situations were I not approachable? How did he feel like he couldn't come and talk to me?
And what do you think that is?
I think a lot of it was based on competitiveness. When the game's ongoing, you know, I'm in it. And yeah. I'm like, if we going, we going. Like, I'm one of the boys, you know, I'm one of the troops. If we going to fight, let's make it a fight. Mm-hmm. Every play. And so I get during that time saying, hey, I'll talk to you tomorrow, whatever. Because during that time, I'm laser focused and I'm on it. You know, we're a group. We got to get this done. But some of it is I made it harder than I needed to based on some things that were said to me by different people that was, it's good, it's good, it's good. But then at the end, it's like, you could do this different. You could do this different. Well, why the hell didn't you just tell me? We didn't sat down and had a beer a couple times.
And you a few said, times, hey, had opportunities.
Yeah, hey, man, you could have did this. Or I need you to do this or this.
You know, and you alluded to this earlier as well, even before we were talking about the coaching piece. But and I heard JT say this recently to a group of kids, is that there were things that were created out of the environment he grew up in and things that he needed to channel to be good at his job. You know, just like you talked about earlier, mm-hmm. there were, you know, to play this game, particularly on the defensive side of the ball, to approach 60 plays in a row as if there's 60 fights and to be physical and dominant and all those things. A lot of the character traits that were required for that didn't really help him when he wasn't playing football, whether that was being a dad, being a husband, being, you know, an employer. And so I wonder, as I'm hearing you say some similar things and then these experiences that you're having with your fellow coaches, do you maybe share some of those same sentiments that JT expressed to this group of kids?
Absolutely. It's not something that you could just turn on and off at the click of the switch. Like, I find myself sometimes, and this is where I know that I can be better, but also that I don't say that Dan Quinn or some of the coaches were wrong, is because I find myself at home getting hot-headed in conversations with my wife or something. And she, listen, baby, listen. Now, you said this, but I thought you meant this, And so she don't give a damn about how hot I get or what my right. mind, she gonna correct it. But all I'm saying, if you my friend, if you take that stance with me, you gotta be able to bring receipts to say, hey man, I couldn't talk to you because of this.
Mm.
Or give me some specific instances where you as my boss came and said something and I didn't do it. Or right. you as my friend came and said something and I didn't try my best to do it. You know, some of it falls on me. Some of it falls on the other person on the other side. But sure. I take the responsibility to where I came up short. And I know that it could be true because, like I say, my wife sometimes has to say, hey, baby, calm down. Calm down. You're talking aggressive. I'm right here. You ain't got to scream. In my mind, I think that I'm just having a normal conversation.
So that's the thing, right? That's what I wonder, because – we all grew up differently and we all engage differently. And when you talked about a leader and a man to man, and we're going to motherfuck each other and then we're going to say, I love you and we're good. Mm-hmm. Not everybody's able to maneuver that way. And so I wonder for you, where you think you are talking it through and working it out and you're going to be fine, if other people are like, whoa, like, I don't know that I could engage in that again. I wonder if and it sounds like that's some of what you're saying.
Well, my wife does it all the time. So I'm saying, I know that it can be done. Right. And I've had coaches before to say to me, I work for five different coaches now. I've had for coaches to say, hey, B, I need you to do this, this, and this. Gotcha, right. I'm on it. And I do that, and that. But if you don't say anything and say I'm doing good, how do I know?
You're just going to do you. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah, I got it. I'd be remiss, man. I know this is going off script a little bit, Big Seth, but I just got to think about that Super Bowl, man. You know what I mean? I know it's a tough deal, man, but I thought you guys did everything you could to win that game, and I thought on the other side they did everything to lose it, man. What was your feeling coming out of that game, man? I mean, I'm such a huge fan of yours, for one, but the whole situation for two, man. I mean, that was interesting how that all went down afterwards.
Well, I tell you again, you know, from the standpoint of us being in the same locker room, I'm not looking to blame anybody.
Right.
From my standpoint in that Super Bowl, again, what could I have done differently? What would I do differently if I'm sitting in that seat again? To me, you don't expect to play 95 plays. But if it take you to play 95 plays to win the Super Bowl, then damn it, you got to play 95 plays.
Right.
What I would have done was rested my guys more in the early parts of the game. My rotation, I was rotating in the first quarter and the second quarter, I was rotating 1-1. okay, first team you go, second team you go. Or I didn't call them second team. We were A and B.
Right.
First group you go, second group you go. And I was rotating them series by series, getting this third quarter, and now I'm rotating one to two. So first group you go, first group you go, B group you go, first group you go, first group you go, B go, B group you go. So now I'm doing 2-to-1 rotation, and my guys just wore down, man.
But it was working though, B. That was, I mean, how do you change what you're doing if that's, if it's been successful? You know, you guys got this lead. I mean, that's hard to change if that was working though, right?
Yeah, but I was in a position where, you know, again, I didn't have the foresight to see that we would play that many plays. And in my mindset, I always like to try to get my backup guys about 20 to 25 plays. My starters, I'd like to get 25 to 45 plays. There's no way in my mindset that I plan to play 94 plays, 95 plays. And so when we ran out of steam, I could tell it was about 7 minutes to go in the fourth quarter, and you get that dead stare look in your face when you're talking and nobody's responding. Everybody's just staring off in space, and you saying to yourself, oh my God, we're in trouble. you know, but I just, when we got to that place, there was nothing for me to do that I could have changed it. And all I would do is just at that point was try to implore the guys, come on, man, we're playing for a Super Bowl. I don't care if you got to play 150 plays, we got to go. And that dead blank stare. And
it, they were gassed.
That's tough.
So I take that. I take that. But I'm not looking to blame anybody. I don't put it on the offense. I don't put it on nobody. If you up that many points, if you stop them, they can't win. We didn't stop them, they won.
Pretty much that simple.
Yeah, man. Damn. I hear you, man. So, B Cox, what is B Cox up to today, man? We talk so much about, you know, being the proud dad and everything, man, and, you know, the coaching and as a player, man. I know you're getting, trying to get back into coaching, man. What is B Cox up to today?
Nothing. Chilling. Man, this has been a hard year for me.
We talked a lot, man. Yeah, I know.
It's been difficult, man. I, with Coach Shula and George Hill, those were gut punches. And then my mom died on August 20th. And I haven't recovered, to be honest, which I just, you know, you're talking about a woman who died at 73, who had cancer, beat cancer, who kidneys were failing, who needed triple bypass heart surgery. For like the last 3 years, she had been on this thing where it was just up and down and nothing was working, man. And so she went to have this triple bypass surgery. And on, I think, August 12th or 13th, and she didn't come out, and I had to make the decision to pull the plug on August 20th.
Yeah.
And it's torn me up. And I did not realize that all the good things about me came from my mom. My strength, my leadership, my toughness, my intelligence, my compassion, all those features that I have that I would consider really good came from her.
Yeah.
And so I got to spend about 3 months with her, you know, prior to her passing, and that made it a little easier. But since she's been gone, man, I can't pick up a golf club. I don't really want to do much anything. I was going to start a podcast. Can't bring myself to do it. And so I'm just trying to relax, man. I'm trying to keep a clear mind. I'm trying to go over things in my mind in case some job opportunities become available. I'd like to work again. I'd like to coach. I think I have something to offer, and not just from a football standpoint, but from a life standpoint. And that's one of the other things that I think that I do really well is I talk to my guys about life coincidences and things that happen in life and, you know, try to navigate them through it. Hey, man, take care of yourself. Take care of your money. Make sure you do a good job with this. And I think that that's one of the things that helps me in the coaching realm. I think that I can be too hard on the guys because I think in my mind, everybody that I work with, I want them to want to have their name on the building. And unfortunately today, everybody don't play for that. Everybody don't play to be great. Some people play just for the money. Some people play for the women. Some people play just to tell their people, oh, I'm in the NFL. I mean, I when I played because I wanted to knock your head off.
Right.
I wanted to be the best. I wanted a statue outside. You know, even though I haven't gotten a statue anywhere, I wanted a statue. I played like I wanted to have a statue outside the stadium because it was that important to me. And, you know, it has taken me a while to understand everybody don't play for the same reasons that I did.
Bro, I tell you what, man, B, I always told guys, play for whatever you're playing for, man, but play 110 for it, whatever it is. If you want the fame, the money, the girls, whatever, I need 110 for that, whatever that cause is, man, because you said it, man. Everybody plays for something different, man.
Right.
Me, I'm with you. I play football instead of baseball for the contact.
Mm-hmm.
I want to hit somebody, man. You know what I mean? And that was a fun part of it for me, bro. Yeah. But play for it. Go 110 for whatever your reason it is, man, and show up every day and work.
Right. People would I don't think anybody ever accused me of trying to injure anybody, but I tried to hurt everybody. When I was out there, I couldn't run. You said it earlier. If a receiver was trying to cross the middle, he was getting knocked down. If you knock him down, you ain't got to cover him.
Right. But the timing's off. It's over. Quarterback, I look somewhere else at that point.
It's over. Or if you got a guy that's a tough running back that don't want to go down, put that hook around his neck. He'll go down. You know, some of these guys out here scared to tackle these big backs, put a hook around their neck. They'll go down. All you got to do is just clothesline them one time. They'll go down.
Just one time.
One good time. That's all they need.
This is what we want to hear out of Brian Cox.
That's right.
It's like so many guys out here are making they're making business decisions. Some of these guys don't want to hit Derrick Henry. That's how I made my money. Bring the bus. Bring him. Come on, let's go. Bring the Nigerian nightmare, Christian Okoye.
Christian Okoye, yeah.
Bring him. That's how I made my money. I couldn't tackle the guys like Kamara at New Orleans,
right?
Or McCaffrey. Them the guys that gave me problems. The Thurman Thomases or the Barry Sanders. Them the guys I couldn't tackle. Bring me a big back any day.
Right.
I'm gonna eat. It's me against him. I'm gonna eat.
They don't make many linebackers like you anymore. Hey, man,
it's some out there. They just, you know, guys play afraid now. Guys play to not get fined. When I'm coaching defensive line, I'm telling those guys, don't worry about the quarterback. You should never get a penalty on the quarterback, ever, because we're going after the ball. I ain't got to touch you. I'm going for the strip.
Right.
I ain't going to hit you in your back. I ain't going to drive you to the ground because I'm going for the ball. If you go for the ball, you would never get a penalty on the quarterback. But if a receiver coming across the middle, I'm trying to kill him.
I know that's right.
I'm trying to kill him because all it takes for you to hit one, and I'm not saying anything illegal. It's not an injury thing. It's a mindset. You make them think. It's all psychology.
That's right.
Well, man, I'm not trying to get hit on the knee, Juice. I don't know.
You can get him out of here before you can hit the knee, Seth.
I'm thinking about that. I'm like, damn, I wouldn't even be able to write a press release if I got hit. That's no good. Brian, all kidding aside, it has been so great to have you here in the tank. First and foremost, let me say this, you know, just blessings to you and your family. Absolutely. And your grieving process. And we wish you nothing but the best and appreciate that you know, you're still willing to give us the time while you're going through all that. But to relive these moments, to tell these stories and, you know, to hear about those Buffalo Bills stories and everything else, it has been just an honor to have you here in the tank.
Appreciate it, man. Wonderful being here.
Number love, B. Cox,
number
man.
Number love, brother.
Thanks for diving in, bro.
Yes, sir.
You're now diving into the fish tank.
Dive up in that fish tank. Who that? Sitting down with Seth Living. Seth. OJ. Juice Woo. Man. Ooh, and this is strictly for them true fans. Yeah. Dolphins. Number one, of course, y'all. This ain't no ordinary sports talk. Dive up in that fish tank. Go get your aqua orange. Yeah, it's time to dive up in that fish tank. It's only legendary talking when you dive up in that fish tank. Rocking with OJ and Seth when you dive up in that fish tank. Fans with attitude, we okay, gotta dive up in that fish tank. Celebrate big or cry hard. Leave it all on the field, we gon' try hard. Old school, a new school, mix it in.
Feeling like we up close when we listening. Dolphins tales in Miami is the deep end. We vibing with our favorite players, no secret. We get with Seth and McDuffie, bringing up stories we never heard to the public. Bet we love it, Dolphins fans never budget. We loyal to the team, whether happy or we upset. We be like, what's next? Don't switch the subject. You know it's all about them fans. And if you ready for that water, time to dive in. Don't switch the subject. You know it's all about them fans. And if you down with Dolphins Nation, time to dive in. Don't switch the subject. You know it's all about them fans. You looking at that fish tank, it's time to dive in. Go get your aqua orange. Yeah, it's time to dive up in that fish tank. It's only legendary talking when you dive up in that fish tank. Rapping with OJ and Seth, time to dive up in that fish tank.